I'm Matthew Allard, the editor of newsshooter.com, and you're listening to The Go Creative Show.
Hey everyone, my name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions. This is The Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals in the video production and filmmaking industries. Today we discuss all the news and announcements from IBC 2019 with Matthew Allard from newsshooter.com. We dive deep into the Sony FX9, Canon C500 Mark II, new lights from Arri and Aputure, the future of RAW recording, and so much more. The Go Creative Show is supported by Rule Boston Camera, Hedge.video, Shutterstock, Magnanimous Rentals, and PremiumBeat.com. Well, we got a huge show for you guys today. All the news and announcements from IBC 2019 with the man at the center of it all, Matthew Allard from newsshooter.com. It's going to be a big one. So many camera announcements, lights, everything, audio, everything that you need to know from IBC is crammed into this episode. So strap in, because it's going to be a wild ride. And you guys, at the end of it, are going to know everything you need to know about the gear and announcements in our great production industry. But before we get there, I want to talk about Rule Boston Camera. Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent all of your production equipment. So a lot of the gear that we talk about today on the show is probably going to be available at Rule soon after, which is great. They have an amazing inventory, so they've got everything you could ever want. But what makes Rule so great is really their service. You know, it's not just about getting the gear. It's not just about having the gear. It's about making sure that you fully understand it and you're working with a company that is supporting you in your production. And that's what Rule Boston Camera is all about. They're going to give you expert advice and counsel in pre-production. They're going to give you technical guidance when you take the equipment out for your shoot. And they're committed to support you while you're on location if you need anything, right? We're talking about peace of mind. So you take the world-class inventory of rental gear, cameras, audio, lighting, grip gear, communication, drones, everything. You pair that with the amazing service, and what you have is an extraordinary relationship with a production partner. And that's what Rule is all about. So check them out at rule.com, R-U-L-E.com. All right. Real quick before we dive into our interview, a couple of things. First, I strongly encourage you guys, please, 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 go and subscribe to us in your podcast app of choice. We find that a lot of people listen to the show that aren't subscribed. They just go to the website, they go to iTunes, they'll just click the play button. But here's the thing, when you subscribe, you get the episodes automatically. So you never have to worry about missing anything. And why would you want to miss an episode? Because we have such amazing guests. We've got the director of photography for The Joker coming on at the beginning of October. And that actually leads me to my next point. When we have guests like that coming on, we always let you know via social media. And that gives you an opportunity to have your question heard on the show. So you've heard this in a couple previous episodes. We'll ask audience questions, we'll give you a little shout out, and there you go. You get noticed on the show. And it's a win-win for everybody because your questions are fantastic, sometimes better than mine. And that's why I love having them too. So follow us, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Will let you know when guests are coming and you can ask your question and we'll ask it on the show. Okay, now let's dive right in because there's a lot to talk about. Right off the heels of IBC 2019, it's Matthew Allard from newsshooter.com. All right, so I'm here with Matt Allard from newsshooter.com, fresh off the heels of IBC 2019. How are you doing, Matt?
I'm good, thanks, Ben. How are you?
I want to go to IBC so bad. It's like, it's the perfect time to go to Amsterdam. It's beautiful there. The weather's great. It just, it seems like a more like, it's easier to navigate as far as like a production gear show goes. NAB is such chaos. IBC seems like it's a lot easier to get around and to absorb everything. Do you find that true?
It's completely different, I think, from sort of NAB. I mean, Amsterdam's a beautiful city. The Rye, where the location where they have IBC every year is sort of nicely laid out. And yeah, it doesn't feel as chaotic as Las Vegas. And certainly the food stands are a whole lot better.
I can imagine. What do you mean? You don't want soft pretzels and nacho cheese all day long?
No, they have lots of nice food trucks, and as media, you get given these food vouchers, so you basically get your sort of meals for free. So it's good sandwiches, and they have curries and all sorts of different sort of food. So it's I think everybody in our crew prefers IBC specifically for the food and the location.
Press eats for free at those things? That's awesome.
Yeah, completely different. And a lot less press, I think, than NAB. The media room tends to be very, very busy. At IBC, it's sort of some more sort of spaced out. And it just feels a little bit more relaxed overall. I mean, IBC is probably more of a broadcast show than NAB is in a lot of ways. But most of the sort of stuff that we tend to cover is all in sort of more concise halls. So it's easier to get around and see things. The stands tend to be a little bit smaller than what you would see at NAB. And it's just a sort of a different sort of crowd being in Europe.
Yeah, NAB, for any of you guys that haven't gone, I mean, I think it's worth going, just the experience. I mean, you got to go once because it's so out of control. But it is total chaos. Like, I spent my entire week last year, or this year, back in April, at the Atomos booth. And I didn't even see anything, really. I mean, I went to just a couple of booths, but I was there most of the time, and it still felt like overwhelming. And I didn't even move out of that one hall. And there's like four or five halls. It's absolutely insane. But even with all of those things going on, NewsShooter really is so good at finding the best stories, the most interesting tech and gear, and really getting, God, how many stories did you have come out during IBC? Like 40 or something like that?
We got up 78 posts, and they were all shot, edited, and uploaded onto the internet, and the story's all written at the end of the 4 days of the show. So everything has already been up there. So the team was working really hard. So we were getting up, 14, 15, 16 articles a day. So it's pretty good for a small sort of six-man crew. There was only one person editing and one person writing.
It really is incredible. Jesus, I was way off. I thought 40. So 70 plus stories from IBC were up by the very end of the event. I mean, that is remarkable. And the coverage is like, it's real coverage. You're not just putting on, the specs and pictures and that's the end of it. Like, in some places there's analysis, you make videos for it. It really is incredible. So we're going to dive into just a few of those things. And I want to start with cameras because, of course, why not? And there were a couple of big camera announcements. Let's start with that Canon C500 Mark II. Tell us kind of what is different about this and how it fits in the lineup of Canon cameras.
Well, this is sort of an interesting one, I think. When I originally got given the specs under NDA originally, I was actually quite surprised because it wasn't really what I was expecting from Canon. I think a lot of people were probably thinking that the C300 Mark III was going to be the camera that came out, but Canon chose to revive the C500. Now, the C500 was not a commercially very successful camera for Canon back in the day. So it was sort of strange that they sort of went with the C500 Mark II. And it's interesting because it's probably the first time I think that Canon has ever really sort of cannibalized their lineup to a certain extent, because the C500 Mark II offers probably, you're looking at about 90% of the functionality of what the C700 full frame offers, which is, a completely different camera at a completely different price point. So it's very interesting to see Canon, aggressively price the C500 Mark II, given its specifications. It's really undercutting the C700. The other interesting thing is that where Canon has placed this camera is sort of quite strange. I mean, we're seeing a very segmented market now where there is a lot of cameras in the under $10,000 range, and then they sort of jump up to 30, 40 and above.
Yeah.
That middle sort of tier where C500 Mark II is being placed, that market has all but sort of disappeared. There's a couple of red cameras that are floating around in there, and also the Sony F5, which is a very old camera. But now that Canon has placed that camera there, I just sort of don't really know where it fits to a certain extent. Because if you have a look at cameras like the C300 Mark II and also the Vericam LT, they were about that sort of range, but now they have been aggressively brought down in price to under $10,000.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a big ask because, yes, it's got very good specifications for a camera, but I don't know how many people are going to jump on board at that sort of price point, because there's a lot of people who are already invested in cameras like the Sony F5 who are probably not going to run out and suddenly buy a full frame camera or even a C500 Mark II in that price point, because it's not probably offering anything that they are required to deliver.
What is the price
point? In terms of people using things like their
five. What is the price point of that C500 Mark II?
The C500, I think, is $15,999. So yeah. It's sort of the same sort of price that Canon has placed the original C300 and the C300 Mark II. They all came out roughly around that sort of price range. So it wouldn't surprise me, within a couple of years where we see that camera's price sort of drop down. But, it's offering pretty impressive specifications, at least on paper, given, what Canon has been doing previously. It was a bit of a shock, I think, for a lot of people to see Canon, bring out a camera with those type of specifications, even at that price point. I mean, people are always going to complain, no camera. People always want a camera that's got everything that's cost them nothing. But unfortunately, it costs a lot of money in terms of research and development for camera companies to come up with these type of cameras. So it'll be interesting to see how the C500 II goes sales-wise.
All right, so let's talk about some of the key features for the C500 Mark II. What's exciting you about this camera? What's new? And, why are people talking about it?
Well, I think, full frame, really, that's the big draw card here. We haven't seen a camera since, the 5D series. And then, of course, Canon C700 full frame. A lot of people have been asking for full frame, and I don't know whether everybody really needs it, but that's the way the market's moving forward.
Yeah.
So with the C500 Mark II, you're getting the exact same sensor that's in the C700 full frame. Mm. So that's a considerably more expensive camera. The other interesting things in here, obviously it can shoot full frame 5.9K at up to 60p, 15 stops of dynamic range, 5-axis sensor stabilization, which is really interesting, putting into this camera. Also, Cinema Raw Light internal recording. This is the same Cinema Raw Light that's you can do in the C200. So that's on board. That's something that the C700 full frame can't do. It can only do RAW externally to a codex recorder. Modular design, can do 2K sensor crop, 120 frames per second. Still, again, with these Canon cameras, they're not really, up to spec in terms of some of the competition when it comes to the higher frame rate options.
Yeah.
User changeable lens mounts. This is a first also for Canon. So it comes with locking EF mount, and you can actually change that to regular EF or PL, and you can do this yourself. This is something that is a first for Canon. Previously, if you wanted this done, you had to take it into a Canon service
center. Yeah, that's
huge.
Now
you can actually change these mounts yourself. So that makes it, a lot more versatile camera. Anamorphic support, which is really good. It's also using the same dual pixel CMOS autofocus with touch autofocus and face detection autofocus that you can find on the C200 and the C300 Mark II. The touch focus screen. 4 channels of XLR with this optional module that you can sort of buy. So, sort of in the realms of what Sony has done for a long time, Canon is actually now offering this sort of optional module that can go on the back. So the whole idea is you can use a standard Canon-style battery on the back, but then if you want to, you can actually take that out, and then this module attaches via some connection pins on the back, and then that gives you the ability to run a VLOC battery, and also gives you 4 channels of audio. It's quite an unusual design on the C500 Mark II, because what they did is they put the two audio connectors and the audio controls without using this module on the non-operator's side, which is a little bit strange for a camera sort of priced at this sort of point with the sort of market that it's intended for. It's really strange. So in some ways, they're almost forcing you to buy that optional module, which I think is about $1,700 from memory. And that sort of moves the audio controls back onto the operator's side. So quite strange in that regard.
Is that all it does, that module? It just moves the channels? Because does it have 4 channels without the module or no?
No.
Okay.
It adds two additional channels of XLR audio, and you've also got some, some optional or some extra SDI ports and things along those lines. But that's pretty much it. It doesn't really do anything more than add those things to the camera. The other interesting thing too is it's now using CF Express media.
Mm.
So this is quite interesting. So this is the first mainstream digital cinema camera that's come out with CF Express. So as you would probably know, the C300 Mark II and the C200 both had the option to be able to use CFast cards.
Yeah.
So Canon has now gone away from that and now they're using CF Express cards. And that's probably to do with a lot of the Cinema Raw light recording and maybe some options coming down the track in terms of, you know, it's a lot faster media. So, yeah, I mean, all in all, fairly sort of, you know, interesting specifications on here. The five-axis stabilization looks very interesting as well.
Yeah, I
so
like
this
that.
This actually works, you know, it works either by itself or if you put a Canon EF mount lens that has IS in it, they'll actually work together. So you can actually sort of tell the system basically what type of lens or focal length that you're using, and then it sort of will adjust accordingly to give you sort of better stabilization. So I haven't actually seen exactly how that works, but from all accounts, it seems to be, you know, a pretty good option, particularly people shooting documentaries and that sort of stuff where there's a lot of handheld work involved.
So it's got the 5.9K sensor. You can record at 5.9K, which is kind of a bummer that the Sony doesn't let you do that, because that Sony FS9 has the 6K sensor, but it only allows you to record in 4K internally and externally, as far as I know. I mean, I could be wrong. So let's dive into that, because that FX9 was also a huge announcement during IBC. For me, especially, because my primary director of photography, Chris Loughran, he's using an FS7. I'm using A7S2s. We've got Sonys all over the place. So anytime there's a new Sony, everybody gets excited. And we are getting excited about this one. And I'd love to get your thoughts on the Sony FX9.
Yeah, I think at first glance, I think a lot of people probably looked at it and were maybe a little bit underwhelmed by the specifications. But you know, as the old saying goes, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah.
The FS7 and the FS7 Mark II are, you know, Sony's highest selling S35 digital cinema cameras and also probably the most sold S35 digital cinema cameras ever produced in the world. They've sold amazing amount of numbers of those cameras, and they've sort of become almost a de facto standard in a lot of places, particularly, you know, the UK, Australia, the US, for instance, as you just mentioned.
Oh, yeah.
There. So I think what Sony have done is it's sort of clever in a way. So they've sort of given people almost what they want. Here's basically an FS, a full frame version of the FS7. You know, with a couple of sort of upgrades that sort of make it work. I mean, they've basically kept the same type of form factor as we've seen before with the FS7. Love it or hate it, you know, they haven't really made too many improvements there. The big difference is that horrible LCD screen that they had on there when used with the loop, which was pretty bad,
yeah.
That's actually now full HD as opposed to being, I think it was only 720 or 1280 or something previously. So that's actually
that
full HD
now. That needed an upgrade badly.
Yes. Yeah, that certainly did need an upgrade. So specifications-wise, a 6K full-frame sensor. Now, the thing is, it doesn't record 6K, at least not yet. Maybe down the track it will. I talked to Sony about this, and they said, you know, the engineers are looking at it. They haven't ruled that out. So possibly that could be something that's offered externally further down. I'm not quite sure about that. The other interesting thing is dual-base ISO of 800 and 4000. And probably the big thing, I think, with this camera is the autofocus system. So this was something that they were probably lagging behind quite a bit from Canon in terms of autofocus performance on cameras of this size.
Yeah.
So this has basically taken the same type of system that's come out in most of the current Alpha series cameras.
Yep.
So you've got the face detection, the eye autofocus, and from all accounts and from some of the footage that I've actually seen, this seems to work, you know, really well. So in terms of a run-and-gun style sort of documentary camera where you want to be shooting, you know, if you're shooting with a full-frame sensor and if you're shooting quite shallow depth of field, then focus is going to be a big issue and it's going to be a struggle. So being able to have that autofocus performance is going to help a lot. Now, this is only going to work, of course, with E-mount lenses. It doesn't work with any other, you know, if you put PL lenses or anything like that on, obviously you're only going to get this when using E-mount lenses. The other thing too, 4 channels of audio it can record. So there's actual 4 separate controls on the side of that camera. Now, the way this works is it's got 2 XLRs, but there's also the MI Hot Shoe on the top. So if you use one of Sony's compatible radio mics there, say a dual channel receiver, so you can actually have two channels coming in through there digitally and then two channels of analog audio coming through your XLRs. So you can record four channels of audio and you've got separate controls for all of that there. Now, I think the thing is, I'm not quite sure, and I think this was the case with the Canon as well, you can do 60 frames per second in UHD, but I think it only does this in a crop, in an S35 crop. I'm pretty sure it doesn't do it in full frame.
Okay.
And again, what you can do is you know, the same old system with Sony as they did with the FS7, FS5, going back to the FS700, you can do external raw recording. Now, this is a bit of a strange one at the moment because it will output 16-bit RAW with an add-on unit. So you remember that there was an extension unit you could put on the back of the FS7 or the FS7 Mark II.
Yes.
That allow you to get that RAW signal out.
And well, I was so upset to hear that you can't use that anymore. And
it's a different configuration apparently. So the old one won't work. So you do need to use that new one that's there. So again, that's additional money that you're going to have to spend to put that module on there. So, you know, in some ways a little bit strange. The other really sort of weird thing for me too is that there's currently absolutely no support for any type of raw recording coming out of the back of that XDCA FX9 extension kit. So you have to buy that but presently it can't record anything over that. So
what do you mean? You're saying no monitor manufacturers are accepting the 16-bit RAW?
Nobody currently can do it. And the even stranger thing is that Sony's own R7 recorder, which can record 16-bit linear RAW, which is the recorder that can be used with the FS7 and also for the F5, F55, and Venice as well, isn't supported.
Really?
Which is quite strange. I asked Sony about this and they said, no, that won't work. And that was a bit bewildering to me. So
what
currently,
what can you get up? Like, can you get 12-bit RAW into like a Shogun or something?
Well, we have no idea yet. At the moment, there's nothing about that in terms of what can be recorded out of there. The only other thing that Sony has mentioned so far is it can output 10-bit 4K at up to 120 frames per second in 10-bit. Now, I'm not sure exactly how this works or what's going to support that as well.
And that's a Super 35.
Yes. The only people who've said that they will be able to record 16-bit linear RAW is Atomos, and that's with one of their huge big neon monitors, which is even stranger because who's going to carry one of those around and then, you know, hook it up to your FS7 sort of on a set. So, I mean, interesting. I'm not sure what's going to actually happen here in terms of, you know, raw support. It's all sort of a bit up in the air. And the other thing, again, is this is classic Sony, is that a lot of these features that they're talking about in the FX9 are going to be firmware updates. So they're not even working currently. So currently, you can only get it, well, when it eventually comes to market in December, you'll only be able to record UHD at up to 60 frames per second. You can't do 4K DCI. That is coming in a future firmware upgrade. Also, the RAW is also coming in a future firmware upgrade. So again, sort of Sony likes to bring out these cameras where they tell you about all these great specifications, all these things it can do, and then it takes quite a while for them to come out. You would have seen this with the Venice, the Sony F5, Sony F55. Sometimes it takes, you know, years for some of these features to actually come out and be implemented. But
well, the
you know,
cool thing
overall,
about
I think it's sorry, go ahead.
No, I was saying the cool thing about that is that your camera can like kind of be with you for a while. Like I still have the FS5 and just recently did the RAW upgrade. And it's like it has a lot of capabilities that aren't yet unlocked when you first buy it, but because things are rolled out over time, it sort of brings you like a new fresh camera every once in a while without having to buy a new camera. Yeah, obviously I want everything the moment it comes out, but I do kind of like having new upgrades to it. I just feel like, and maybe it's a marketing thing, but I just feel like my camera becomes more valuable over time. I can keep it longer, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's very much a rationale behind all of that. If you have a look at the Sony F5 and the F55, those cameras are, you know, 7 years old now.
Yeah.
I think coming up towards 8 years old. And they are still very much, you know, requested in a lot of applications for shooters to use. So yeah, they rolled that over, and to their credit, Sony hasn't replaced those cameras. Now, what's interesting too about the F5 and the F55 is when I talked to Sony is that they basically said, we have no plans to renew that line whatsoever.
Wow.
So basically what's going to happen is once they've sort of run their course, you're going to have, you know, FS7 Mark II, FX9, and then you're going to jump all the way to Venice. So again, you're seeing a manufacturer here sort of abandoning that middle ground, because obviously there's not a lot of sales happening there. And we're tending to see people buying a lot of cameras now because of the specifications that are under $10,000. And if they need anything better than that, they're renting.
Yeah.
So there's not a huge big market for people buying cameras in that middle ground. And the other thing you'll be happy about too, Ben, finally with the FX9, is that finally it has time code and gen lock.
Yes, I heard. That's great.
So no more sort of having to, you know, not being able to jam up cameras, et cetera, et cetera. That was, a heavily requested feature that was missing on the FS7, the FS7 Mark II. So the other thing too as well is that this is certainly not an FS7 Mark II replacement. That camera will still remain in the lineup and still be supported by Sony. The FX9 is just another addition to that. We haven't seen any price drops from the FS7 Mark II. We did see the FS7 drop down, though, too, by, I think, $1,500. I think you can now buy the original FS7 for, I think it's $5,995.
You are listening to the PremiumBeat.com Song of the Week. It's called Positive Ideas by Sound Design. Premium Beat is where to go for all of your royalty-free music and sound effects. Check out their website. There is a collection of thousands of royalty-free tracks for as low as $49 each. $49! And you don't just get the one single song, no! You get cup downs and loop sets and stems and basically, what you really get is the ability to customize the track to fit your project perfectly. So you go to the site, you fall in love with your track, and now you can fit it into your project and make it sound perfect. And isn't music 50% of your project anyway, right? So make it a good track. Head over to premiumbeat.com and check it out for yourself, premiumbeat.com. And I want to talk about Magnanimous Rentals before we get back to our interview. Magnanimous Rentals is an equipment rental house in Chicago, but they ship all around the country, so you don't have to live in Chicago to take advantage of what I am about to say. And you're going to want to, because here's the thing. Magnanimous Rentals over at magrents.com, they have a great inventory. They have a lot of really cool equipment there, but where they cannot be beat is their price. They just can't. Their regular prices are amazing. But then on top of that, they have these things called flash discounts. And these are items that are steeply discounted. I'm talking sometimes like up to 50% off, okay? Steeply discounted items. However, it's only for a limited time. So you have to place the order while the flash discount is going on. But that doesn't mean you have to have the equipment sent to your house while the discount's going on. No, just placing the order, and you can have it sent whenever you want. But you're going to want to take advantage of it. But here's the thing. It's a limited time. So you need to make sure that you go to magrents.com every single day and see what they have to offer. And this isn't any crappy little products here on flash discount. I mean, I personally rented an Alexa Mini on flash discount. It was like 45% off. It was crazy. And there's all sorts of things. There's lenses and cameras and gear, and it's always new cool stuff, and it's always the stuff that you want, and it's always steeply, steeply discounted. So head over there right now and every day following magrents.com, magrents.com. Before we move on to lighting and audio and all the other things, I want to get a better understanding of what dual base ISO is. Because I hear about it a lot. The FX9 has dual base ISO at 800 to 4,000. But what does that even really mean? And how is that beneficial to us?
Yeah, this is sort of, it's a little bit complicated technically, I think, to explain, but I'll do my best. So basically, there are two analog circuits right after each pixel before the gain amplifier. So one each is dedicated to the two different ISOs. So in the case of the FX9, one is dedicated to 800 and the other is dedicated to 4000. So this allows for two native clean settings. So switching between these two values of 800 and 4000 allows the camera to keep the signal to noise ratio the same and allows you to shoot cleaner images in low light conditions. Now, from past experience using cameras with dual native ISO, I wouldn't say it's not a magic trick. It's not going to look exactly the same at 800 as it will at 4000, but it is considerably cleaner. If you look at the new Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera 6K, for instance, that's got a dual native ISO as well. And it's quite interesting. If you do tests with that camera, because of the way the two dual native ISOs are set up, that if you go suddenly to, you know, the higher dual native ISO, and then you go down, it's cleaner than using the lower one at, say, 1,000. So if you ran 1,000 ISO, 1,000 ISO using the lower native ISO is actually going to be noisier than what 1250 will be.
Wow, okay.
So it sort of works that sort of way. So it's a bit hard to explain on a podcast, but if you actually saw how it would work, you would see that, yes, there is big benefits to having a dual native ISO and it is quite a lot cleaner, but there still is going to be some noise there. I mean, you can have these two different systems to create two different native ISOs, but at the end of the day, you're still having to add gain to an image to get light in there and boost the signal. So it's just a way of basically controlling that gain and reducing the amount of noise that's present. That's probably the easiest way of explaining it.
And I think that's so basically, if you had the ability to shoot exactly at 800 or exactly at 4,000, those are your best, cleanest options.
Yeah, I mean, it works differently with different cameras. In something like the Panasonic S1H, for instance, which is coming out very, very soon, that's very much the case where it's got two different levels there where you have to set it. And then so if you're shooting in anything, you know, above a certain ISO, then it's better to go to the higher one and then actually go down, because what it's doing is it's actually using that gain circuit from, say, whatever it happens to be. I can't remember on the S1H, maybe it's 2500 or something. If you're going down but you're using the base ISO at 2500, then those levels down below are also going to be a lot cleaner than if you use, say, the 800 ISO and then you go up, for instance. So
yeah,
it's not necessarily about having them at 800 or 400. I mean, basically the dual native ISOs that companies come up with, you know, a native ISO doesn't really mean anything. It's basically where a company thinks that they can get the most dynamic range out of their camera.
Yeah.
Is basically where that is. It's not necessarily to do with noise levels or anything like that. It's just that where they'll work the best. And so when you have a dual native ISO, that's also at those higher ISOs, that's where they're trying to keep as much dynamic range as possible. I mean, it won't be as much as what you're going to get probably at the lower ISO, but it's going to be a lot better than using, another ISO and not a dual native ISO, because as soon as you start going up, you start losing dynamic range in a lot of cases as soon as the ISO starts shifting. So the way of having dual native ISOs is also a way of, you know, keeping better dynamic range as well as getting cleaner images.
Let's talk about RAW. ProRes RAW came out when? Was it 2018 NAB? It was a while ago, and it didn't really catch on quickly.
Actually, it was 2017.
2017, oh my God.
2017 when it was originally announced, because I remember doing an article just before NAB. Oh no, actually, you're right, 2018, because I did an article this year just before NAB called, you know, ProRes RAW 1 year on, because I was very interested to see what had happened with ProRes RAW, because it had been out for an entire year and sort of not much had sort of moved on in terms of support and implementation into other devices.
So there was
a few announcements at NAB, but now at IBC, I mean, huge big news, I mean, particularly probably for a company like Atomos, is that now, you know, it not only got picked up by Avid, but then
Premiere.
Adobe jumped on there with Premiere Pro, and also Edius as well now supports it.
And up until that point, it was only Final Cut Pro.
Yes.
And it's crazy because like everybody clearly wants RAW capabilities, but they're all a little bit different. Like I think people think of RAW and they think of it the way that they do in photography, where you can control everything, or Red RAW, where you can control everything. ProRes RAW is different, and all these other camera manufacturers have their own RAWs, and they're different as well. Do we feel like there's a standard coming for RAW? What is the future of it, and kind of what are your thoughts? What should people know about it?
Well, it's sort of interesting. I mean, I think one of the German publications called Slashcam, you know, wrote an article entitled, I think, RAW Wars, because that's sort of what we're seeing at the moment. We're seeing this sort of sort of battle for supremacy in terms of more of an industry standard RAW codec. And that battle's solely been between ProRes RAW and Blackmagic RAW.
Yeah.
So Blackmagic RAW also announced plugins for various other NLEs as well, but they're, you know, it's not natively supported. It's a plugin that you have to use.
Yeah.
And quite interesting, you know, with Blackmagic, because, you know, a lot of their sales pushes for some of their cameras was, oh, you know, you can record Blackmagic RAW internally on these cameras. And then they bought out these new video assist monitor recorders at IBC, which actually will record in Blackmagic RAW. So you can use cameras like the EVA-1 and the C300 Mark II, and you can actually record Blackmagic RAW if you choose. So that's sort of a big move from them, because they're almost inviting you to buy somebody else's camera and not buy theirs to get sort of the similar benefits of being able to record in RAW. Now, I think, you know, it was sort of head in head there with Blackmagic RAW and ProRes RAW. And we can, you know, you could argue till the cows come home the benefits of each individual system, because they work quite differently. But fundamentally now, I think ProRes RAW has got a leg up, because now that being adopted into all these NLEs. And of course, it's probably not going to come to DaVinci Resolve being owned by Blackmagic.
Yeah.
I'm not sure they're going to back that horse in that race.
They may have to, though, if the demand is high in every camera, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's good to see some sort of standard. I mean, I wouldn't say it's a standard yet by a long way, because as you said, there's still so many codecs and so many different forms of RAW available. And I think, you know, the big thing will be this sort of whole battle that's going on at the moment between Apple and Red, in terms of, Red is being looked at by Apple now, and they're sort of going to court looking at, I don't want to get into too much legal trouble here, but
what's the validity
of Red's patent, basically, for recording, you know, compressed RAW recording in camera.
Mm.
At 24 frames per second. That's now being looked at by Apple. A lot of companies have looked at this before and done the same dance in court with Red. But now Apple has gone in there, because obviously, you know, they want to push ProRes RAW forward. You know, if they're looking at promoting, you know, and pushing professional equipment into the marketplace again, like they're now doing with the Mac Pro and all these other various things, trying to push that element, then, you know, Final Cut Pro and ProRes RAW and stuff like that are a big part of that. So if this Red patent somehow gets overturned, then that opens up the doors for everybody. And then you'll find that all these different RAW formats, proprietary RAW formats, could possibly disappear. And then you're going to have the likes of ProRes RAW being able to be recorded inside cameras. Now, that's going to be huge, I think. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways, you know, Atomos is almost in the box seat here, because I think they sort of got a horse in both races, so to speak, because
absolutely,
they've probably got some type of involvement, because they were involved with starting up ProRes RAW with Apple. So I think for them, you know, it doesn't matter which way it goes, because they're going to be happy either way.
So the conflict is that Red has a patent on the ability to record a compressed RAW in camera, and Apple wants it so that they can also have, they can sell licenses to other camera manufacturers to record ProRes RAW, to record ProRes RAW in camera. Am I understanding that right? Is that?
Exactly. That's okay. Why you'll see all of these other cameras apart, you know, anybody who wants to record a form of compressed RAW currently has to do it externally. So if that's the reason why all the Sony cameras have an external RAW recorder.
Yeah.
It's why you're seeing like Atomos having external RAW recorders to be able from various cameras. Everybody else doing that as well. The only exceptions is if you do, basically uncompressed. So if you record uncompressed RAW inside your camera, such as what Arri does, mm-hmm. that doesn't interfere with any patents. But as soon as you want to compress that RAW and record it in camera, that's a patent that currently Red owns. So if you wanted to use that or license that, you would either have to pay Red money or somehow come up to some commercial agreement with them.
Wow. I would hate to have Apple's lawyers coming up against me for something. That'd be horrifying. I mean, I just feel like, oh my God, there's so much steam being built for ProRes RAW. All the camera a lot of the camera manufacturers are starting to embrace it through monitors. You've got Apple behind you. Man, it's like, it's a little scary seeing that that mob with torches coming at you. I would be nervous.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, we still got to run into the problems. And despite it being compressed RAW, you know, ProRes RAW or Blackmagic RAW, still take up an awful lot of room. And you can look at the merits both ways of how many people actually need to shoot RAW as opposed to people who are shooting RAW.
Yeah.
I mean, still very much in production environments, doing bread and butter sort of work, news, documentaries, corporate work, all that sort of thing. Nobody's requesting, you know, RAW in most regards. You know, a lot of the times they don't even want ProRes because the files are too big. So
yeah, I just did. I was saying
get to a point where the media becomes, you know, cheap enough to store all your material on, and that sort of side catches up, then yeah, maybe there'll be a benefit to it, and we might move into that sort of situation where photography went, where basically, you know, you just shoot RAW because you can and it's easy enough, and it's not really a hindrance on your workflow or your ability to create content.
Yeah, I got the RAW upgrade for the FS5, like I was saying just a little while ago, and you know, I got the I didn't get a Shogun 7 for that, so I wasn't able to record ProRes RAW. But even with the Odyssey 7Q Plus, I think it is, I looked at it, I recorded a few minutes and it RAW, and I'm like, you know what, this file size is ridiculous. So I ended up just doing like that downgrade to the I think it was I can't remember the exact specs, but it came in 12-bit RAW, and I think it went to like a 444 ProRes or something like that. It was better than what the sensor could do, way better than what better than what the camera internals can do. It looked awesome. It wasn't RAW, but it still looked great. And like, I had so much room and color. It's one of those things where it's like, I like the idea of being able to shoot and record ProRes RAW, but I don't know if I'm going to do it for most things, you know, especially not interviews, maybe commercials, but two hour long interviews, forget it.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. Because I think the whole thing is with this whole sort of RAW scenario that's happening now is that it's almost sort of like the resolution push to a certain extent is it's something else you can sell to consumers, because internal codecs in a lot of cameras now are becoming so good and a lot more efficient that the need to record externally, you know, it's debatable as to whether you actually need to record externally on a lot of cameras and whether you're going to get, you know, quality that's, you know, a lot better or distinguishable by you, the user, as to whether it's worth it. So, you know, just like resolution, I think, you know, you have to push things forward to sort of adopt and want people to use them. But if we do end up with, you know, a free-for-all in terms of, you know, compressed RAW being recorded in cameras, it could sort of change everything. And we're just as likely to see, you know, another 15 different standards pop up once something's allowed. And, you know, we go back to that same scenario where there is no standard and it's basically a free-for-all of codecs like it sort of currently is now. It would be great with everything. We were discussing this at IBC on our end-of-show panel. If there was like standards for a lot of things, it would make everything a lot easier. It would make sourcing equipment a lot easier. It would make post-production a lot easier if there was just certain standards that everybody used.
It would be great. And I want to put a link to that wrap-up video in our show notes, because you, Dan Chung, and Eric Naso did a great job and it was an awesome conversation. So I certainly want people to look at that video. But Eric brought up a really good point that sometimes standardizing things could inhibit innovation because, you know, is this RAW wars, as we're calling it, is this where the innovation is right now? And if there were a standard, does it stifle that? I don't know. I mean, I thought that was a good point and an interesting, you know, interesting idea.
Well, it does certainly hold things back. I think, you know, I guess the way to get around standards and other things is it does create, you know, people going out there and trying to come up with something new to a certain extent. I mean, I don't know overall in the entire industry whether it would actually hurt or hinder anything. because maybe people could concentrate on other elements of products and not concentrate on, you know, a codec or a certain, you know, a certain type of way to do something if everything was sort of standardized, because then they could spend the time and energy, you know, making something else about their product slightly better. It's an interesting argument. I can see both sides.
Yeah. Let's take a quick moment and talk about Hedge. Hedge.video, of course, is the backup software for filmmakers that is super easy, intuitive. It gives you peace of mind knowing that your media is being backed up correctly. Now, just think about that. Peace of mind. Here's the thing. You can import multiple sources and send it to multiple destinations at the same time. So you're on set. You've got a bunch of camera cards. You have an audio card. Maybe you have like a behind-the-scenes photographer or a drone or something going on. You can take all of that media, throw it into your computer. At the same time, you can put it into Hedge and send it to however many destinations you want. Like I always do two different hard drives because I want a double backup. You can do three, you can do one, you can do whatever you want. Then I press transfer, I let it all go, and I'm notified on my phone because I have the Hedge Connect app for my phone. I'm notified when the transfer is done. So everything is done professionally, everything is done super fast, and then I don't have to worry about it. Think about it. I'm not just dragging files all over the Finder like I used to. No, those days are over. My media is getting the respect it deserves. And it's being treated professionally because finally I'm using a professional software for my backups. Hedge, you should do it too. Go to hedge.video/go-creative-show. You get a 20% off discount on the full license. And they have different licenses too, so you don't have to buy the full license. You can go there, explore, try it out, get a free trial, see what you think. Because I know once you play with it, even just once, you will say, I cannot live without this app. So head over there, hedge.video/go-creative-show, and give it a shot for yourself. I know you are going to love it. And lastly, let's talk about Shutterstock.com. Now, you're going to hear me say something that I've never said before on the show, but I want to focus on color theory, right? Okay, how does that relate to Shutterstock.com? Well, here's the thing. Shutterstock is the place, obviously, for footage and photos and music and all those things. It's a stock media website. And you all know it and you already love it. But they also have this section called tools. Now, if you go to their website and you scroll over tools, there's a whole bunch of stuff here. And I'm going to bring up all of these things in episodes, you know, going down the line. But I'm going to start here with color schemes. This is awesome. This is basically like a color theory education all on this site. You go here, you pick a color, and then it gives you a palette that you can then go and use, you know, for your projects. But it also gives you photos that are related to that color palette. So, you know, think about it. Now, you don't need this all the time, but when you're putting an edit together, when you have a strong color palette, it makes your project better. It just does. And these are the elements that make good design. And you can get this right at your little fingertips from Shutterstock. So you go there, you click on a color. I'm clicking on royal blue right now. And it brings up a whole different type of color palette here. So I can do a mono color palette, an analogous, a contrast, a triad. And then underneath it is a whole bunch of images that are within that color palette. So if I was putting together an edit and I needed some background plates or just some clips that kind of blend well together, it's all there for me. It's already curated based on my color. How cool is that? And that's just one of the many tools over at Shutterstock.com. So yes, go there for their images and their footage and all the things I've always been talking about, but explore the tool tab because there's a whole bunch of cool stuff there that you will be hearing more about in future episodes. So there it is, Shutterstock.com. Let's talk about lighting a little bit. This Arri Orbiter, again, a light that I'm never going to own, but I want, looks amazing. I feel like there's more and more this push to having HMI replacements, super high-end LEDs, really high-powered LEDs, and computerized components to lights. Like this, the day of just throwing up, you know, like a tungsten kit, it's over. And everything is becoming a computer. And I'm so interested in what this Arri Orbiter is and what it's all about. I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. It's packed with sensors. It has a 4-inch panel on the back. It's crazy. What are your thoughts? Tell us about it.
This is a really sort of interesting light. It's been quite a long time since Arri has sort of brought out anything new in the lighting world. You know, they had the sky panels and they've been around for a long time now, but they really got in with the sky panel at the very birth of sort of RGB technology. So
yeah.
In a lot of ways, you know, a lot of people still compare the sky panels to other lights, and that's an old light now, really. So, you know, to their credit, they've brought out tons of different firmware upgrades for that light over the years and still made it very relevant. And it's still a huge, big, you know, in rental houses, they're stocked everywhere because they're just super robust. But
yeah, we just used them last week on a commercial. I love them. I absolutely love them. And paired with the Alexa Mini, it's like the perfect pairing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I think a lot of people complain that they have a bit of a green spike and, you know, they have a certain sort of look to them. And the thing is, those lights were basically manufactured and produced to work with Arri cameras. So if you use a sky panel with an Arri camera, you're going to get a lot better result than if you use it with, say, a Sony or a Panasonic, because it's mapped basically to sort of work with the sensor.
It's interesting.
Most Arri cameras.
I never knew that it was mapped until I saw your video that I keep referencing, the wrap up. And I'm sure you've mentioned it before, maybe even on this show, but I didn't absorb it. But I have heard of the green spikes with other cameras using those sky panels. So that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that's just one of those things. It's like everything, you know, what you've got to be mindful of with a lot of lights is that certain lights will work better with certain cameras than others. It's just simply because of the way the color and the sensor reads color and the way it gets processed, that certain lights will look better. It's almost like the same with certain lenses tend to look better on certain cameras than others. And I guess it's everything sort of playing nicely together.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this Orbiter. What is it, I guess, and what makes it so interesting?
Well, this is a really sort of interesting feature. And I was interested to find out sort of, you know, why they came up with this light and how long it had taken. And it's taken quite a long time for Arri to bring out the Orbiter. And I think it's called the Orbiter. I'm just going to guess this. I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure it's got something to do with the moon landing, the 50th anniversary of the moon landing.
Could be.
Because it's sort of got like a little moon sort of logo on the side of it, if you look carefully, that's engraved into the side.
Yeah.
I should have asked about that, but I didn't. So this is sort of going back to where I think lighting has sort of moved in the last few years. We're now starting to see a lot of multi-versatile lighting tools coming to market. It's not enough these days to just bring out a light that does, you know, one thing. We've seen this whole craze with RGB and effects and color gels and, you know, being able to manipulate colors and all this sort of thing. But now, you know, basically everybody's got that. So what's the next thing? What do you come up with that changes lighting? Again, this is an interesting light, the Orbiter, because it's sort of, you know, I basically said to the guy from Arri, it's basically like the Swiss Army knife of lights.
Yeah.
Because the whole idea is that it's a fixture that you can use to create a soft light, a hard light. You can use it with these different optics that come out so that you can open face, projection, dome. You can turn it into a light bank. You can basically make it do anything that you want on set. And what's interesting is that it's using an LED array, which is like a COB, so chip on board LED. But this has been specifically made and developed for Arri, this particular LED. So what they've been able to do is shrink the size of the COB down dramatically. So I think compared to Arri's M10, I think it's something like 73 times smaller.
Wow.
In terms of,
wow.
So that's taken a long time. So they basically, they envisaged this particular light, but they had to wait for all the technology to catch up to be able to build it. So, I mean, this thing is really like basically a computer with a light attached. That's probably the best way of describing it in a lot of regards. So, you know, wide gamut light engine, 6-color spectra, it's super powerful. There's all these sort of operating sensors on the back, waterproof housing, all these integrated color sensors. So it's got sensors all over the light. So it's extremely clever. So even at the front, when you change the optional optics on the front of it, so you put the different type of projectors or whatever on the front, it actually has a little sensor pin on there. So the sensor talks to the adapter that you put on the front, and then it tells the light what adapter you've got on there.
Wow.
So if you've got something at a particular degree angle, it then knows where to channel and funnel that light because it knows what projector's on there. And then what I found quite amazing too is that it had all these other sort of sensors on board. So if you're shooting something, for instance, and the ambient lighting suddenly changes for some reason, say you're shooting outdoors or something at night and a car comes past and the light changes, it can actually change the light according to the light source that's out there ambiently and then change it back automatically once it goes past. So if a car goes past, it can basically change the light to replicate what that car's headlights is doing. And as soon as the car's gone past, it goes back to whatever it was set at before.
Yeah, I was thinking about that in terms of what we do, because a lot of times we're thrown into a location and our windows are kind of our primary light source. And even if they're not, they're lighting the room. You know, they might not be the key light, but there's ambience from the windows in the room. And there's always changing. A cloud goes over. You know, you interview while the sun is going down. Things are constantly changing. And something that seemed really appealing to me about this is because of those sensors, at least it seems like, it would be able to adapt to the color in the room, which I think is really cool.
Yeah. And, in talking about, all the type of functionality that's inside this light as well, I mean, as I said before, it's just like a giant computer. So Ari told me that it's got 125 times more memory than the sky panels in there. So
the whole idea
with making this light is that it's going to be, they said there's going to be an extensive array of software and firmware updates, in the future to add functionality to this particular light. I mean, it's pretty crazy too, because it's got a 6-color light engine in there. So it actually has red, green, blue, amber, cyan, and lime LEDs. I think this is the first time I've ever seen a light that's had that many different colored LEDs in there. So the amount of colors that it can actually create is pretty crazy. And also it has a CCT range of 2000 Kelvin up to 20,000 Kelvin. So, there's a lot to like about this particular light, and the way it works with DMX and Arri's other systems and stuff. And, in terms of its size, it's fairly big light, but a lot of connectivity on there to do a whole bunch of different things. Again, it's weatherproof, robust, so it'll be perfect for rental houses. And I was sort of a bit surprised by the price. Apparently, it's only going to be around $7,000, which sounds like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money. But, we were talking about this at the show, and I was sort of thinking it would be more towards like $15,000. So
why?
Well, I don't know. Just because of that, you have a look at the previous Arri lights and you have a thing, look at something like the Arri Sky Panel 360, that's like €30,000.
Yeah.
So given the functionality that's inside this light, I expected it to be a lot more. But, I think Arri will probably, sell out of these things before it's even available. And I don't expect this light to be available until, sometime in probably mid-2020. So you're going to be waiting a while if you're interested in buying an orbiter.
I want to talk about the Aperture 600D. It is, the next evolution of Aperture. It's coming after the 300D Mark II, which is extremely popular, and it's being touted as an HMI equivalent LED light. What are your thoughts? I know you got a chance to play around with it a little bit.
It looks to be a pretty impressive light. I mean, Aperture's always, offered pretty good value for money lights that strike a good combination between performance and price and functionality. The 600D is supposed to be the equivalent of an 800 watt HMI. 600 watts of output draws 720 watts of power. So, if you want to power this, it's going to be mains power, or they do offer a quad plate battery pack. So if you had big enough batteries, yes, you could power this, but, it's probably not the best light to be powered remotely by. It is quite a lot bigger.
It's bulky. It's bulky. It's kind of like squat, and it still has that big, huge ballast. But as Aperture does, they give you a really good quality light at a reasonable price range. Like this, their lights are lights that you can buy. You know what I mean? It's like the Arri lights we were just talking about, even at $7,000, it's just when your lights are the same prices as your camera, it starts to become something that you can't really buy. And Aperture does a great job of making lights that are powerful, LED, and that are in that price range that are actually like buyable.
Yeah, I think they've targeted the indie shooter and they've continued to sort of target that owner-operator market where, again, yeah, people don't want to spend $3,000 on a light. I mean, the 300 D Mark II, I think, was around about $1,000. So it offers very good value for money, as you said. So for people looking for a big source that they can then put a big soft box on and create a nice soft light, the 600 D looks to be a really nice fixture. Now, if you want to run this off batteries, you're going to have to use 28.8 volt batteries. You can't use the 14.4 volt. So that's a little bit of a hindrance, I think, particularly for people who are, looking at buying this light. They're probably not going to be the same sort of people who are going to be buying 28.8 volt batteries to use. But again, this is probably not something you're going to use outdoors anyway. This is, probably a very good key light for an interview or lighting up a room. The lights offer a good balance of performance at a reasonable price, as you said before. Again, it's going to be a while before this light comes out. Aputure tends to announce lights and then sometimes they run into a few problems and it takes a little longer than they said. They're hoping to release this in the first quarter of 2020, but we'll see about that. No word on pricing yet, but I would expect it to still be reasonably affordable given it's an Aputure light.
I want to talk about this Xylight Go panel because it has active diffusion and I really don't know what that is. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on what it is and if this is going to be a trend in LEDs moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, active diffusion is something that, we've seen a few companies try and work on this for quite a long time. I think Shimura was actually trying to show something at NAB probably 3 or 4 years ago, and I don't think it ever sort of got to market. Now, the Xylight is actually bringing this Go panel light to market that does have this active diffusion. So basically, it's like electronic diffusion. That's probably the best way to describe it. So rather than putting diffusion in front of your light, you're basically dialing it into the fixture as you would with brightness or color temperature. So on the back of the light, you can actually sort of create your diffusion. So what this does is, it's basically sort of just spreading the light out more. That's probably the easiest way of thinking about how this actually sort of works. Now, the trouble when you do this, and we can talk about the Roto light in a minute because this is doing very similar sort of thing. But what happens is that you have to apply an electric charge to the LEDs to be able to do this, to change this, to change the sort of the angle of where it's going out and diffuse them up.
Sort of like a variable ND type of a thing?
Yeah, exactly. This is exactly the same as basically how variable ND works. Now, the problem is when you apply a charge to these sort of things, what happens is you introduce color shifts.
Mm.
So basically, it sort of skews the color. So what you need is a processor that's got fancy technology inside that can counteract and map that out as it's happening. So this is exactly the same as you said with variable electronic ND that you would find in, say, the FS7 Mark II and the FS5. Is that's the same thing. People sometimes complain that there's a bit of a color shift when they're using the electronic variable ND because it's doing the same thing.
Yeah,
it's actually going to change the color slightly by adding an electronic charge to whatever it's being used inside that. I'm not sure exactly how the variable ND works, but it's the same sort of principle as this. As you apply a charge to this, it's going to do a bit of a color shift. So
you notice a big shift in color, or was it able to kind of fix it?
Oh, no, it was pretty hard to see. I mean, the thing with these lights too is that I don't really know if it really works that well from my honest perspective, because the trouble is with diffusion, you almost need, you need a gap.
Yeah, you need to be far away from it.
You need a gap between your light and wherever your diffusion is. And the problem is, because this is doing this on the LEDs, you're not really getting that sort of diffusion. It's sort of just spreading the light out. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm still up in the air about whether it's worthwhile or not.
So what was that other light that you had mentioned that kind of uses active diffusion?
Well, not calling it active diffusion, but this is the Roto Light Titan X2. So this is a large 2x1 LED, RGB WW fixture. So it's very much a direct competitor to lights like the Light Panels Gemini and the Arri Sky Panels S60C. So they released this just before IBC, and this looks like to be a pretty impressive light. This is not only Roto Light's first RGB WW light, but it's also their first light that's actually not round. So if you're familiar with Roto Light, they've made round fixtures in the past. So now they've moved to making this 2x1 light. So now Roto Light is claiming that this is the brightest 2x1 soft light ever made. So they say that the output of this is going to be higher than a sky panel or a light panel's Gemini. So it's got a lot of interesting functionality in it. And we were talking about active diffusion before. So this is doing something that's, it's not called active diffusion, but it's actually called smart soft is what they're calling here. So basically it's the same sort of thing as we just sort of mentioned before, where they apply electric charge to the LEDs. And then basically you can either, it's either flooding or spotting the light. So by doing this, you're not really, I mean, it's a bit, I don't know, I wouldn't go as far as saying it's misleading to say that it's diffusing the light, because it sort of is. So basically what you're doing is you can change the beam angle between 68 and 150 degrees. Instead of doing this like a Fresnel or something would do, you're basically doing this by using the charge and manipulating how the LED is throwing the light out there. So you can actually have a very wide, soft lighting source, or you can spot it up. So again, it comes back to this whole type of thing of, you know, functionality, and a lot of lights now where the software is just as important as the hardware. If we go back to the Orbiter, when I talked to Ari, they said, hey, look, now we employ more software guys now than we do hardware guys, which was probably, you know, something they never thought was going to happen maybe 4 or 5 years ago. But now all of these lights now are becoming sort of almost like mini computers. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago where you couldn't upgrade a light. And now basically every light is getting firmware updates and they're adding new features and changing things up. So again, moving forward, I think this is something we're going to see in the future, where we're going to see these lights becoming more of a sort of Swiss Army knife in terms of being able to do multiple different things, and you won't need to buy multiple lights to do, you know, multiple different things. You'll be able to buy one light that can be used in a variety of different ways.
Now, we only have a couple minutes left, and I'm already apologizing to our big audio people out there, because we are not representing audio well in this episode, and I certainly apologize, but we only have a couple minutes left, and there were other things to talk about. So let's just take our last couple minutes and talk about, you know, maybe one or two of the big audio stories from IBC. My guess is you're going to want to talk about this Sound Devices 833. Is it a replacement for the 633? And, you know, if so, how does it compare to that? What is it, the Scorpio, I think, that they were talking about in NAB? It was something like that.
Well, I mean, this one was interesting, but I think what's more important is to talk about the Mix Pre 2 series.
Oh, okay.
Is a lot more relevant here, because I don't know if you've heard this term 32-bit float.
No, actually, the first time I heard it was you guys talking on your wrap-up show. I'd never heard of that before. What is it?
I mean, again, I'm not an audio guy, so I, you know, when someone said it's got 32-bit float, that means nothing to me. You know, they could be talking about anything. So I was actually interested to find out what that actually was. So I went around to Sound Devices. So they've had the Mix Pre series for a couple of years now. You know, very good quality, multi-versatile recorder mixers that you can use that are reasonably affordable. So they did an update and they brought out a version 2. So the version 2 has got this thing called 32-bit float. Now, most current audio mixer recorders do something called 24-bit float. So basically, this is just a way of describing, you know, sort of the dynamic range of audio and how much headroom you have in terms of before you can clip things. Now, the difference between 24-bit float and 32-bit float is almost like going from, say, like 8-bit to 12-bit in terms of, like, you know, the amount of colors you could see.
Yeah.
But in terms of audio, this is how much headroom you get. So it was interesting to see a demonstration. The guy at Sound Devices said basically the amount of dynamic range that you get with 32-bit float was something like 1,530 dB. And he said, that is absolutely ridiculous, because the human body actually explodes at, I think, like 230 dB in terms of like audio range. I don't know why he brought that up, but he did. So he did this really clever demonstration. So he said, okay, here's the best way of showing you what the difference is. So he took a 24-bit recording, and it was like overmodulated. So it was peaking, it was off the scale. And so when he tried to reduce that down, you still had these hard clips. So it's basically, you know, the information there's gone. So with 32-bit float, it's almost like raw recording for audio. That's probably the easiest way of picturing it in your head.
Like you're not blowing out the highlights sort of an idea.
Yes. Yep. So he took the exact same clip. And again, when you look at it, it's blown out and it's clipped and peaked. And so there shouldn't be anything there. But when he started bringing the level down, everything came back to normal.
Wow.
So it didn't matter how overly clipped or overly modulated your recording was, you can recover it like nothing ever happened. And the exact same thing as well as if you had the recording level was very, very low, you can just bring it back up with no noise floor increase.
Wow.
So this was amazing. So for people doing audio or particularly people who are not using sound recorders, you know, you have the ability to be able to just set a level, and then if somebody starts screaming or something like that, or somebody bumps the switch and you're recording low, you've got the ability to recover all that information almost in the same sort of way as what's probably a better way than what you could do with, say, a camera raw. So this is a huge new advancement, having this 32-bit float implementation in there. Now, he did say that it's not just a simple case of having 32-bit float. You do need to have pretty good like preamps and all that sort of stuff inside there to make it work.
Sure.
And I was a bit worried. I thought, oh, maybe you're going to have to use some sort of, you know, particular software to work with 32-bit float. But he said, no, a lot of the major NLEs, Final Cut and a couple of the others, are supporting 32-bit float natively. So if you bring in a 32-bit float recording, it's just there and it knows it's 32-bit float, then you can adjust all the levels accordingly and get the benefits of using it. So for me, this was probably, I don't know, I like the small things. I thought this was one of the bigger announcements that I heard at NAB, because in terms of audio, if this is a way of being able to get good audio, you know, that's not clipped or over-modulated, that's really good. I mean, it's not going to save you if you put the microphone in the wrong position in the first place, but if you're careful at what you're doing, then you're going to be able to recover these things that you previously couldn't do before. So it'll be interesting to see how long it takes before anyone tries to implement this inside a camera directly.
And it's small. I mean, they have it paired with a Sony Alpha Series camera, like a little mirrorless, and it's about the width of it. It's tiny. It's a little tiny thing.
They make, I think, three different versions with different inputs in them. I think that's the Mix 3, that small one that you can use, and that's three channels of audio, and also pretty impressive too that it also has time code in and time code out. It can also generate its own time code, and it can also read the time code from a mirrorless or DSLR camera that can output time code over HDMI. So again, you don't even need to use a time code locking device. You can actually sync this thing up directly and then have it record without having to lock it up.
That's pretty cool. So it looks like it just plugs in, maybe sends a mix to the camera for reference, and then just records internally. Am I right?
Yep, exactly. Yep. Record to an SD card and have a backup that's perfectly time code matched to your camera, or actually take an output out and just feed it into, you know, any camera, whether it be a professional digital cinema camera or a smaller mirrorless or something along those lines that doesn't have particularly good onboard audio capabilities.
So all the things we talked about today will be in the show notes. And of course, there is so much more from IBC on newsshooter.com. Matt, you guys absolutely killed it this year, as always. I mean, I don't know how you do it. You have a small team and you're pumping out story after story after story. It's incredible. And we're so thankful that you come on Go Creative Show every time and talk to us about your experience. We love having you, and already excited for the next big show, which is probably, what, NAB New York? Or that's like the next thing. There's not a ton of announcements from that, but just so thankful that you come on and talk to us.
Yeah, there will be some other things. And I apologize to any of the listeners out there if I did get anything wrong in there. I'm trying to recall a lot of information, so some of it may be slightly wrong. So please check the site for to see if I actually got it right.
What a way to go out. I might be wrong. And thank you. I love that. All right, perfect. Well, thank you so much, Matt, for being on Go Creative Show. And we'll definitely have you back. And of course, all of you guys check out newsshooter.com daily, hourly, moment to moment, because there's stuff coming out all the time. Matt, thank you so much for being on. And we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, Ben.
I want to thank Matthew Allard from newsshooter.com coming on the show, talking to us about his experience. That guy is the best in the business. If you're not a NewsShooter reader, you should be. So head over there, newsshooter.com. I also want to thank our own Matt. We have a Matt of our own. His name is Matt Russell, and he mixes, masters, and makes the show sound so good. You can hire him for your own projects by finding him at gainstructure.com and on Twitter at gainstructure. I also want to thank our producer, Connor Crosby, from Ignition Visuals for putting this show together, ignitionvisuals.com. And of course, our sponsors, Rule Boston Camera, Magnanimous Rentals, Shutterstock, Premium Beat, and Hedge. Without these people, the show wouldn't exist. So please, please, please support those that support us. And also, follow us on social media. Subscribe to us in your favorite podcast app. And we will keep pumping out these episodes for you week after week. Bye-bye.